Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Alice Bryant, Phil Dierking, and Jonathan Evans. But first, this report.
Whether it is mathematics or history, almost everyone has at least one subject they find to be more difficult to understand than other subjects. Some students may not be strong academically, lacking the skills they need to succeed in writing or taking tests. Others may have a learning disability or lack the study guides or other resources they need to support them in their learning. But does that mean that a given person should not have the same chances as others to help themselves through higher education? Scott Tykert says no. Tykert is the director of admissions at Weber State University, a public university in Ogden, Utah. He says his school and others like it were established with the idea that higher education should be open to all people. How? Weber State accepts students through a process called open enrollment. Most colleges and universities in the United States require applicants to provide records of their academic performance in high school. Students are also required to provide results of standardized tests, lists of their activities outside of school, and letters of support from former teachers.
Schools then decide to admit applicants based on how well they have performed academically and whatever other qualities school officials desire in a student. Millions of people seek entry to the higher education system in the United States every year. And with only about 4,600 colleges and universities nationwide, competition for admission can be intense. Most applicants apply to more than one school to give themselves a better chance of gaining acceptance. In some cases, only the students with the strongest academic records or list of activities are admitted. But Tykert argues that just because a highly selective school rejects an applicant does not mean that he or she is less intelligent. Nor does it mean the individual is less hardworking or unworthy of higher education. That is why some American states have established schools that use open enrollment in their admissions process, he says. A school with open enrollment does not compare applicants in terms of their past academic performance. The main requirement is simply proof that an applicant has successfully completed an American high school level study program or something that is equal to it. This shows that the person is academically ready for a college environment and willing to do the work required of them, says Tykert. Why is it so simple to enter a school with open enrollment? Tykert suggests it is because almost all of these colleges and universities receive some kind of public money. So they have a responsibility to help people improve their lives and support themselves.
They are built upon the idea that education is a public good, Tykert told VOA. So open enrollment institutions want to make it affordable and accessible to as many students as possible. Tykert notes that Americans might say community colleges do exactly that. After all, they are low-cost public schools with less selective admissions requirements. Yet community colleges only offer two-year degree programs. And many community college students start their higher education at these schools only to eventually move onto four-year institutions. But many institutions with open enrollment offer four-year degrees, and some, like Weber State, even offer master's degree programs. These degrees are awarded after 1 or 2 years of additional study. Tykert adds that open enrollment can be very helpful for international students. At schools like Weber State, the only other major requirement for admission is the results of an English language skills test, such as the TOEFL. However, applicants should not lead themselves to believe that simply because the application process is easy, the study program will be too, notes Tykert. Open enrollment institutions are accredited in the same way selective schools are. This means the education they offer must be of the same high quality, and the students are expected to perform just as strongly as they would anywhere else. At Weber State, for example, students who enter into a given field of study may be asked to change study programs if they show signs they are struggling.
You have to remember that open enrollment is simply about making the institution as open as possible, said Tykert. Once you're into the institution, you still need to make sure that you're performing well. Selective admissions programs judge you coming into the institution. At open enrollment institutions, it's mostly based on your performance after you've been admitted. Many of the colleges and universities in the United States are said to be among the best in the world. This is especially true of the 8 highly selective private institutions known as Ivy League schools. These 8 have long been seen as offering the best education. Also, many people believe that having a degree from an Ivy League college or university would likely lead to them getting the best jobs. So some people might ask that if one could possibly attend one of these schools, why consider a school that accepts almost anyone? Tykert admits this is a fair question. But he argues that some of the professors at places like Weber State attended Ivy League schools themselves. As a result, they are able to share their Ivy League level education with their students. Also, he says, many employers care more about the kind of person they choose for a job than where that person went to school. Some people don't even know the difference between open enrollment and a selective institution, said Tykert. So whether or not you pay 3 times as much at the research institution down the street as what you do at an open enrollment school in the same state, sometimes employers wouldn't even know the difference. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we are going to talk about a favorite physical activity. Swimming. Whether outdoors or indoors, Swimming is a fun way to stay in shape. And one of the great things about swimming is diving. For a very short time, a diver flies through the air like a bird. Then they land in the cold water below, usually with their hands and head leading the way. But jumping into a body of water head first is just one meaning of the word dive. To dive into something can also mean to start working on a project with lots of energy, but not, perhaps, a lot of planning. Let's say two friends are really excited to dive into a new business together. They are so excited that they open their business without a clear idea of how to market their company, or even who will buy their product. So it was not a big surprise when their company went under a few months later. Friends told them that they had a good idea, but they simply dove in too quickly. Now, adding the word head first adds importance. If you dive into something head first, you are even more excited and perhaps even less prepared. For example, a man I know really wanted to learn basic home repair. He was very excited to begin on a home project. So he dove in head first, knocking down walls and tearing out the floors. Unfortunately, he didn't know enough to rebuild his house. He ended up hiring a construction team for that. To dive into something can also mean you are simply really excited to do it. Planning is not an issue or a problem. And sometimes we add the word right. This makes it sound more conversational. For example, the children must have been very hungry after swimming all day. They dove right into the pizza the minute it was served. But now, let's go back to the diving that relates to swimming. Sometimes divers dive off a mountain cliff. They are called cliff divers. Some dive off the side of a pool. Others dive off a diving board. Diving boards are springy. They are made of a material that can bend. Diving boards are a kind of springboard. They are a board that springs you into the air. In addition to diving, a springboard is useful in other situations. A springboard can be something that helps you start an activity or process. We can also call this a jumping-off point, just as when you jump off a diving board. For example, when preparing for this program, I often take note of the expressions my friends use. So for me, these conversations are often springboards to new stories for this show. The term springboard can also mean a point of departure. Let's hear two coworkers use it this way.
Boy, Emmanuel did not stay long at his job here, did he?
No, but I'm not surprised. I knew he'd move quickly from this job to the next.
How did you know that?
On his first day, he told me that this job was only a springboard to a better position.
I see. Well, at least he was honest.
Okay, so besides cliff diving and diving off a diving board, there is another kind of diving, scuba diving. Scuba diving is an underwater activity. You swim underwater while wearing special equipment, including a tank or container filled with compressed air. SCUBA is an acronym. It is short for Self-Contained Underwater Breathing Apparatus. With tanks of air on their backs, scuba divers are able to dive deep into the sea. On a deep sea dive, you might see some very strange sea creatures. On land, a deep dive is when you explore an issue in great detail. Oftentimes, the media coverage of some issues is too shallow, meaning it doesn't explain enough. But sometimes a news agency is able to do a deep dive on issues that people really care about. You could say that on Words and Their Stories, we dive deeper into the English language. Hopefully, this program will make you want to dive right into your English studies. I'm Ana Mateo.
Asian food is the fastest growing cuisine in the United States. Between 1999 and 2015, sales of Asian fast food rose 135%, beating Latin and Middle Eastern cuisines. That information comes from market research firm Euromonitor. Several things are pushing this growth, says Andrew Koh. He wrote the 2009 book Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States. A big change began in 1965 with the passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. That opened the door for a lot of immigrants from Asian countries, he said. There are a lot more Asians from different countries, and they brought their food with them. A Pew Research Center report says there were 20 million Asian Americans in 2017. That is an increase of 72% since 2000, making the Asian population the fastest growing group in the country. Koh said there are other reasons for Asian food's sharp rise in popularity. American business is involved with every country in the world, and we're very aware of other countries and cultures, he said. We're interested in the things they eat, a lot more interested than we used to be. He noted that younger people are more willing to try new foods. Look at Korean. No one thought it would be hip. Now it's hip, he said. Koh added that with immigration, we have those people here who can prepare the food correctly. Worldwide, about 90% of Asian restaurants are small and independent. But in the United States, large restaurant chains make up about 50% of sales of Asian cuisine. Panda Express is one example. It had $2 billion in sales in 2014, the Washington Post reported. Jay Sullivan is the head cook for Pei Wei Asian Diner, an Asian fast casual restaurant. The first Pei Wei opened in 2000. There are now more than 200 locations across the U.S. Sullivan said Chinese food has been here long enough that people, especially younger people, are very familiar with it. His first experience with Asian cuisine was 18 years ago. I remember being blown away by not only unlocking the mysteries of Chinese food, but also exposure to Southeast Asian cuisine, he said. He added that people now want to eat healthier. Many kinds of Asian food are thought to be healthy because of the high amount of fresh ingredients and vegetables. But traditional American cuisine has very large servings and is heavy on protein and starch, Sullivan added. He noted, however, that many favorite Asian dishes are full of calories. He said that is something he is trying to change. Sullivan said that thanks to the internet, Asian food recipes are more available than ever. And as the Asian population in America grows, more and more stores are selling key Asian ingredients that used to be hard to find. And if there is not an Asian market nearby, many ingredients are available online. Sullivan also said Asian influences are affecting non-Asian food. He said more and more people come from a mix of cultures, so mixing cuisines is normal. Korean tacos, a popular dish, are just one example. I'm Alice Bryant.
For many years, the Muppets have captured the imagination of children and adults worldwide. The Muppets were the creation of the American puppeteer Jim Henson. He used the term Muppet for his puppet act. Many people first learned about the Muppets through Sesame Street, a children's program on public television in the United States. The Muppets later had their own TV show and have appeared in movies. Recently, a traveling exhibit called the Jim Henson Exhibition, Imagination Unlimited, opened in Los Angeles, California. It can be seen at the Skirball Cultural Center. Visitors are able to take a close look at some of the most beloved Muppets, including Kermit the Frog, Miss Piggy, and the Count. The exhibit helps to show what is required to bring them to life. If you learn from Sesame Street, he, the Count, teaches you how to count. There's Cookie Monster. He does the ABCs every episode, said 9-year-old Ellie Fire. She spoke to VOA during her visit to the Skirball Cultural Center. Jim Henson's oldest daughter, Lisa, says she is excited for people to understand that her father was an artist with many abilities and a creative mind. Lisa Henson is now the president and chief executive officer of the Jim Henson Company, which is based in Los Angeles. She remembers that her father wanted the family to be involved in the Muppets.
He would love to tell us how the best techniques of puppet building were the new innovations that they would make in terms of mechanics or electronics, and how he was advancing the technology.
The wide popularity of Henson's work led to TV series such as The Muppet Show and Fraggle Rock. Within a short time, the Muppets became famous in other countries. Barbara Miller is senior curator of collections and exhibitions at Museum of the Moving Image in New York. She said that Jim Henson understood the popularity of the Muppets and that they reached children and adults around the world. Remember, The Muppet Show was seen in 135 countries at its height, she said. Miller added that her museum in New York has a permanent Jim Henson exhibit.
Lisa Henson said her father felt a duty to be hopeful about the future and to support good values like acceptance, tolerance, individualism, and diversity. The exhibit not only has more than 100 objects and 25 historic puppets, visitors also can see what it took to bring the Muppets to life. You can see original sketches, actual notes of the very beginnings of ideas, all the way through to finished puppets, said Lisa Henson. The show is a creative experience that tells the life story of Jim Henson and his work from the 1930s to 1990, when he died. Although computer-made images may have replaced some puppets in Hollywood productions, Lisa Henson said, "The art of puppetry is still important today."
It gives it a kind of immediacy in performance and intimacy that people connect to that, and they kind of feel like that, you know, the puppets are a little more alive. And so I don't think puppets will ever go entirely out of style.
Miller said the aim is to continue to take the Jim Henson exhibit to other U.S. cities and overseas. I'm Phil Dierking.
Croatians and Frenchmen are set to cheer for their teams in the final match of the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Moscow on Sunday. For others, there is a choice between pelmeni or kachapuri. In the past month, football fans from around the world have come to Russia to cheer on their country's teams. Many have a chance to taste Russian food for the first time. There is borscht soup made with beets and red cabbage. Pelmeni are Russian dumplings packed with lamb, pork, or beef. Smoked salmon or salted herring are sometimes served with pancakes. And Russian salad is known internationally as potato salad. However, Russians claim their salad is fresher and crispier. David Gregory is a football fan from England.
We've been eating some traditional Russian food, smoked meat and bean soup, lovely, and I've had a mutton stew.
His friend Simon Jones tried other dishes.
I had the chicken wings and the smoked bean casserole as well. Great food, great culture.
Some Brazilian fans tried dishes that went beyond traditional Russian food. Marcelo Magaish from Sao Paulo says his group tried a cheese-filled bread called kachapuri, a dish from Georgia. It was served in the shape of a boat. He said it was a pasta which had an egg yolk and a light cheese. It was really tasty, so I ordered another and another and another. Beer has been a popular drink among fans as well. One bar manager decided to give his customers a special treat. He served them beer in a traditional Russian container usually used to heat water for tea. No matter who wins the World Cup match on Sunday, many fans are going home with new favorite foods. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.